yea or yea. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give the attention for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 063088 et al. United States of America versus Gwendolyn M. Henfield Appellant. Ms. Lukey for Appellant Henfield, Ms. Jones for Appellant Baxter, Ms. Kerr for Appellate.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please this Court. I'd like to start with the issues where the government has conceded error. And that begins with the hundreds, if not thousands, of pieces of evidence either put in evidence or depicted on summary charts without foundation. The government has conceded an intention to provide evidence of a foundation through a 902 certificate of authenticity as to the hundreds of thousands of pieces of evidence and transactions, but they cannot point to the record site where they introduced the authenticity of these documents into evidence. They relied on a rule they didn't follow. They apparently intended to introduce them but didn't. They have conceded they didn't, and they have not said it's harmless because they can't. There were hundreds and thousands of these documents, and there were well over 40, if not 50, charts. The charts took up one-third, if not half, of the case. This was significant evidence that came in without a foundation. The second issue I'd like to talk about that the government has conceded is the district court's failure to give a limiting instruction repeatedly. We made the objection when the evidence first came in that it was admissible. It was not admissible for all purposes. The judge found that it was not admissible for all purposes, indicating that it might be appropriate to give a limiting instruction to ensure, quote, to ensure that the jurors appreciate that the evidence that they are relying upon could only be used for purposes of establishing conspiracy and not the embezzlement counts. This was evidence of hundreds of transactions establishing embezzlements that were not charged or were not referenced in the indictment in any way. Once the court acknowledged that they were coming in for only the purpose of proving conspiracy, although that was disputed, we asked for a limiting instruction pursuant to Rule 105. The court said he wasn't going to give it then. He would think about giving it at the end of the evidence. Upon his making that argument, I proffered to the court this court's decision in U.S. v. Bronner, which requires that the rule requires that the instruction be given on request. But Bronner makes it clear that it must be given upon request at the time the evidence is admitted. So the jury knows when the evidence is admitted, when they see it for the first time, what it's coming in for. The court continued to refuse and refused over 60 additional times my request every time one of these pieces of evidence came in that he had already said were only coming in for one purpose, refused again and again and again and again to give a limiting instruction. He alluded to the fact that he might give it at the end, which I submit to the court wouldn't have been good enough anyway. And then at the end, when I asked for it with final instructions, he refused to give it again. The government simply cannot respond to this evidence, this argument. In fact, they don't even reference Rule 105 in their brief. It's not even in the table of authority. It's not even listed as something that was important in this case. They've conceded it. It was error. The counts of conviction for the substantive counts must be reversed. Speedy trial, Your Honors. This issue involves the government's naked motion to give itself more time, maybe 25 days or so before the speedy trial clock ran. They made a motion, 2 pages. Didn't say the case was complex or complicated or anything like that. It said the defendants needed more time to prepare. I'm not even sure the government had standing to make that motion. But in any event, Mrs. Hempel opposed it, didn't need more time, wanted a speedy trial. The court may recall there was a lot of press pre-trial, and Mrs. Hempel demanded at the first opportunity a speedy trial and an opportunity to confront the evidence, never wavered from that request. The court refused to set a trial date. This pretextual motion came in before the speedy trial clock ran. The government said, The defense needs more time to review the discovery. The defense, at least in the person of Mrs. Hemphill, said, no, we don't. We want our trial. The judge, in any event, waited for the speedy trial clock to run and then granted the government's motion over our objection. There's an interesting footnote in the government's brief at, I think it's 42, I'm not sure what page it's on, where the government acknowledges that if it was a pattern that the government had of filing such motions, motions that indicate that the defense needs more time, that the district court would have a way of taking care of that if it were a pattern. But this is Mrs. Hemphill's right to a speedy trial. And they did it in this case to Mrs. Hemphill. They deprived her of anything that the act gave her. And if the government is allowed to do that, Your Honors, then the government is allowed to extend the Speedy Trial Act any time they want.
What was the ground on which the court granted the motion?
I'm not sure what words he used.
Well, was it
but he may have said, he may have decided himself after
the complex case, wasn't it?
Well, we did not view it as a complex case.
No. Isn't that the district judge said?
I think he may have mused that, and I'm not sure where it is in the record, but I might be able to find it.
Don't you have to establish that it's frivolous, or as you said, pretextual, before you get anywhere with that?
I think I do, but I think I can. We didn't ask for more time.
It's not the fact that it's a motion. You have to establish that this was not a complex case. So far from being a complex case that it was a frivolous motion?
Well, no, I think, first of all, if the motion's inappropriate, it doesn't toll the clock. The judge
court grants the motion.
The court.
And therefore makes it appropriate. You have to tell us that the court's decision was so wrong that it was frivolous.
The court did not grant the government's motion. The court apparently on its own decided the case was complex. The government's motion was for more time for the defense. It was not based on an allegation of complexity. It was 2 pages long, and it said, we need to give them discovery, and they need to review it, and they're not going to be able to review it in time. It wasn't their motion that he granted. If he did anything along the lines of deciding it was complex, he did it sua sponte after the time had run. That motion should not have tolled the clock. The government points to the Supreme Court case where a motion tolls the Speedy Trial Act or the clock, but it's a motion, and it almost always is, filed by the defense. And that makes sense. If the defense needs more time and asks for it, the Speedy Trial Act should be tolled. But if the government, having no standing or no right to ask for time for me...
Is it your argument that if the judge sua sponte decides it's complex and rules in that event, regardless of what motion was filed, that that's error?
No,
okay,
it's my...
So then aren't you still back to the question that Judge Garland asked you? If the judge's determination that the case was complex is not challengeable, what's left to your argument?
Because if he ruled sua sponte and yes. Not on the government's motion, because they didn't say it was complex, he did it after the clock had run, therefore he told it nunc pro tunc, which he cannot do.
I see. But now, isn't there a connection between the government's motion and his decision, that is to say, arguing that we need more time for discovery, or the defense need more time for discovery is another way of saying it's complex, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, I would dispute that. It seems to me that if they're going to say it's complex, they need to say it. Because that's what the statute anticipates that they will say and that they will make a case for. But when you file a 2-page motion and you don't say it, and you don't give the judge any reasons to believe it, only to believe that I'm going to need more time, which is not an argument for you to make, I would respectfully decline to agree that the judge ruled on their motion. If anything, he ruled sua sponte after the time had run. But I need to go faster.
That's a good point.
Thank you. I'm going to move to the next issue, which I think is extremely important, and I still have to get to Castigar. This is the issue of being cut off in cross-examining a key witness in the case on the issue of his gambling. Leroy Holmes was, by the government's own words, a vital link in the testimony against Mrs. Hemphill. He was, in the instance where we were trying to get the evidence of gambling across, the only witness. It was his word against hers as to who had stolen cash. We tried to establish through...
I think you made this point well enough in the brief. Can we talk about Castigar? You've got like 37 seconds left.
I will talk about Castigar.
Yeah.
The only issue with Castigar is the government says derivative use was made. We say direct use was made.
Let me just see if I understand. Your view about direct use, I'm looking at the reply brief at page 13. Your view is that if the government attorney participates, this is a Queen for a Day proffer, correct? That's what you have?
No, Your Honor.
You think it's different?
I do think it's different.
What would you describe as a Queen for a Day proffer?
A Queen for a Day proffer, at least in the last 10 years, specifically waives Castigar.
It has a specific provision saying?
A specific provision. Uh-huh. Moreover, it uses the words proffer. It uses certain words. I would say that this was a cross between a prelude to a plea and a Queen for a Day. But
your view that is under this specific, under this proffer, this...
agreement?
Well, it's not really agreement. You got a letter, right?
It's an agreement signed by both parties. I'm not sure where it is in the joint appendix.
It's A-1702. Your understanding of this was that if the government trial attorney participated in this debriefing, that trial attorney could not thereafter participate in the grand jury and indict your client?
No.
What is the meaning of, on page 13, number 2, the indictment issued after the government trial counsel was exposed contain nearly verbatim language from those statements?
You're reading from the rebuttal argument, but the position below and
your reply,
that...
I'm reading from your reply brief.
The rebuttal argument in the reply brief adds to a list of things that seemed like they might provide grist for the use mill. What we relied upon below was the fact that the agent who sat and took 16 single-space pages went into the grand jury and testified.
Yeah, let me first... your view is not that the... You think a government attorney could debrief your client and then still participate in a grand jury and indict?
Without a Castigar hearing, I can't answer that question.
I see. So the government, your view is the government intended when they sent this that they would either let your client go, accept a plea, or have to have a Castigar hearing before they could indict your client?
I did not participate in this hearing, in this agreement, but I know that my client expected the government would not use the information she gave them. Yeah, that's what she expected.
I'm trying to focus
the
on
the question
three.
Is, what is the threshold? Who's got the burden?
I think once we establish a use, and I would submit that North 2, a use is when a witness reads and then testifies.
I need to ask you to answer the specific question.
I'm sorry.
First question is your understanding of this agreement that if the prosecutor participated in the debriefing, prosecutor then had only three choices: either not indict your client, take a plea, or subject him or herself to a Castigar proceeding before that prosecutor could indict your client.
It's hard to answer that question, but I would suspect that once somebody gives testimony under an agreement that says somebody won't use it, they're entitled to find out whether that person used it.
Your answer is yes.
I think she's entitled to a Castigar hearing.
Okay. Now, similarly, if the agent on the case participates in that proceeding and then later testifies, we don't know what they're testify about. They can't testify in the grand jury either without submitting to a Castigar hearing.
A Castigar hearing is for the purpose of finding out whether there was use.
I just need a yes or no. I'm trying to figure out what you mean
yes.
by the word use.
A Castigar hearing must occur once you establish there was a use.
So the government basically has to realize that if they're going to have a paper like this, they should expect a Castigar hearing.
And for the last
case.
5 years, they have realized that because most of these have a Castigar waiver in
any
it.
Has any district court ever held a Castigar hearing in the last 5 years?
On this kind of
document.
You know, I'm not sure they have because these documents don't exist anymore. Now you waive it. When you do a Queen for a Day proffer, you specifically waive Castigar.
Up until 2002, when they used this document, any district court ever hold a Castigar hearing?
Not that I'm aware of, but we wouldn't necessarily be aware of that. But Your Honor, with all due respect, the law in this circuit, since U.S. v. North, has been if a witness reads immunized statements or information.
It's immunized under the statute.
And it doesn't matter, given Kilroy, whether it's under the statute or not. If a witness reads immunized statement, you almost have to have a Castigar hearing to find out if they used it. In this case, we proffered to the court real use.
You know what the agreement said in Kilroy, right?
Yes, I do.
It included the words derivative use.
Yes, but North, when it talks about direct use, doesn't say derivative. It says, I can imagine no more direct a use than when a witness reads immunized testimony.
Well, wait a minute. In North, the witness read the immunized testimony and then changed his position with respect to the trial testimony.
But, Your Honor, in North, there was a Castigar hearing, so you knew what had happened. Here, we don't know what happened because we never got a hearing. It's true that the agent took four statements, testified in the grand jury three times. It's true that a trial witness, Mr. Novak, read the statement, created a chart, one of the most damning charts in the trial, testified against her in the trial. Repeatedly, I asked for a Castigar hearing. Who else saw this? How did it affect their testimony? How did it shape their testimony?
Counsel, if I understand your position, under the agreement you signed, dividing derivative and direct use. Anytime the government wants to use derivative use, they have to prove in a Castigar hearing it's not direct use.
No, Your Honor. In fact,
isn't that basically your position?
No, it's not, Your Honor. The government has mischaracterized my position that way. All the evidence in this case was derivative. Mrs. Hempel was the first person to speak to them. She led them to every single other witness. Every other witness who pled guilty and testified against her was derivative. We never made a single objection to that. The objection was when we saw the agent who testified being the one who took her statement, and we read North.
I still don't understand. What is it that gives an indication that it was direct rather than derivative?
What gives an indication is the law of this circuit.
No. In this case, what is it that made the witness's testimony look like it was based on direct rather than derivative?
We gave, at A7116, we gave a use chronology, and there are other exhibits in there. When we saw the indictment, my client recognized her words, so we made our first move. When we got the grand jury testimony of the agent, we saw testimony. The agent at the time she...
I'm trying to get at what point is your threshold... reached where you, under your contention, you have enough prima facie evidence of direct use that switches to an Castigar hearing?
I think at the point I got the grand jury testimony of the agent and I saw in there things that had come directly from Mrs. Hemphill's statement, and I knew that the agent had no other 302s at that time because I had all the 302s. I knew that she had used the information given her by Mrs. Hemphill in the grand jury, and it made me seek a hearing to find out how many witnesses who testified in the grand jury had seen her statements, how many witnesses at trial had seen her statements, what effect had it had on their testimony, what effect had it had on them, all of the things that are pointed out in North. And to me, the most puzzling thing about the government's argument is this circuit has made clear what direct use is. It isn't just putting something in as evidence.
So you think if it affects a witness's testimony, that's direct use?
No, I think if they use it. That agent had nothing but her testimony when she testified. Therefore, ipso facto, she used it.
Okay, we have the argument. Thank you.
May I have 2 minutes, sir?
You may.
Thank you.
That's what we got. Ms. Jones, right?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, Your Honors. My name is Lisa Jones. I represent Appellant James Baxter in this matter. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of rebuttal time as well. Your Honors, the trial court erred when it refused to instruct the jury on a multiple conspiracy instruction. That error was not harmless and it substantially prejudiced Mr. Baxter. The court was required to give that instruction when requested by the defense, and the record evidence supported a factual issue for the jury's determination. I would submit that the government is wrong that the defendants did not request raise the issue that the evidence was in variance with the indictment on several occasions, A, and B, that the defense did not specifically request a an instruction to the jury to find, to determine as a factual basis or a factual matter whether the government had proved a single conspiracy as opposed to a multiple conspiracy. And therefore, if they found that a multiple conspiracy had been found, that they should, the jury, that is, should acquit the defendants.
Counsel,
yes,
do you think that's your strongest argument?
I'm sorry,
Your Honor? May I suggest you go to what you think is your strongest arguments?
Well, I would argue
that
that's
the strongest.
Well, in addition to the fact that the error was not harmless because the evidence against Mr. Baxter was so underwhelming, to put it politely, by the government, there was
really. How about I was sort of reviewing over the testimony. You have Martha Britton testifying that the charges on Baxter's Amex card, which indicating he was using the card more as a personal card than a business card. The Wizards tickets were in Baxter's name. He charged over $84,000 on his Amex card, $14,000 for restaurant meals, during a time when he was not engaged in any lobbying, $3,200 for framing a piece of art that was hung in his house, $392,000 in W-2U checks to himself, true for alleged salary, $6,000 check for a salary advance, but there's no indication that that advance was ever paid back. The evidence is underwhelming?
Yes, Your Honor. As to, we'll just take it down the list. As it relates to the government's argument that the payments for pension and other salary.
The pension, isn't that Gossamer? He had a separate pension plan.
That was earned income, and the government's expert does not dispute that whether there was a formal pension plan administrator. There were other employees at the union, including Ms. Britton, who from time to time received payments outside of the pension administrator. There was no intent by just that fact. That
wasn't the jury entitled to believe that was looting the Treasury?
Your Honor, the jury was in the entire looking at the evidence in its entirety. Given that the government has conceded facts that support Mr. Baxter's contention that A, that he was as much deceived by the twins of deception, Ms. Bullock and Ms. Hemphill, as anyone else, and that the government's argument criminalizing Mr. Baxter's signature as the elected treasurer of the union, based on these and based on the fact that he was lumped in contravention to Katiakis, lumped together with all of these other people, without an instruction to the jury that it should parse the government's evidence relating to the evidence proffered at trial versus his indictment, substantially prejudiced.
One of the things really astonished me was that Wizard tickets would be $20,000.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That's one of the things that astonished me, that Wizard tickets would be $20,000. I'm not a basketball fan.
Well, that's what they are, Your Honor. And every law firm and every lobbying firm in the city has the Wizards
tickets. It wasn't lobbying.
It doesn't matter, Your Honor. A law firm doesn't lobby either. But he was still the elected treasurer. He was still entitled to be paid. The Constitution indicated that he was entitled to be paid. He was still doing other work. There's no dispute about that.
Counsel, I have found it very difficult to hear the argument that the jury was not entitled to infer from all of this evidence that he was at the, if not at the epicenter of the conspiracy, he was certainly part of it.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree and respectfully still argue that he was entitled to the instruction from the jury. The court was obligated to do that under the prevailing law in this circuit. Your Honor, the trial court held Baxter liable when he sentenced Mr. Baxter for a penny in and a penny out for the unforeseen crimes of Ms. Bullock, Ms. Henfield.
Sorry, I can't hear you, counsel.
For the unforeseen crimes of Ms. Bullock and Ms. Henfield. The trial court failed to make any findings, much less explicit findings, as to the scope of Mr. Baxter's agreement with Ms. Bullock and the rest of those conspirators.
Was an objection on that ground made at the sentencing?
Your Honor?
Was there an objection on that ground, the failure to make the findings made at the sentencing?
No, Your Honor, and I would submit that, and I can't remember the case, I'm going to be quite honest with you, but I would submit that under prevailing law, there is not a requirement at sentencing to object to every issues regarding sentencing at the sentencing hearing.
Well, when do you think the objections have to be made?
Well, on appeal, A, but B, but there was also a request before sentencing that findings be made by the trial court.
By the scope of the conspiracy?
I would argue, Your Honor, that the request by Mr. Baxter's first trial counsel and then his superseding sentencing counsel in their arguments regarding that the court needed to find specific facts as to the loss calculation.
Can you tell me where you, if it would be helpful if you told me where in the sentencing transcript of Mr. Baxter that they actually made that argument that there had to be a finding about the scope?
I'm talking about the papers that were submitted, the many papers that were submitted on behalf of Mr. Baxter and Ms. Hemphill prior to and leading up to the sentencing.
Specifically with respect to Mr. Baxter, if you want, when you sit down, if you could find the joint appendix citation for the papers that you're talking about.
Surely, Your Honor. Surely, Your Honor. But nevertheless, I would argue, Your Honor, that the court nevertheless did not spell out, as he was required to, whether there was an objection or not, or whether it was requested or not.
Well, he may still be required, but as you know, the difference is whether we apply plain error or harmless error.
I understand that, Your Honor.
If it's not an objection, you don't lose it altogether, but the standard is considerably different. That's why I want to know whether there was one.
And I will certainly find that citation, Your Honor. But but whether it's a harmless error or a plain error standard, Your Honor, the fact that the judge lumped together in terms of the scope of the agreement, James Baxter with Gwen Hemphill, was a substantial error and substantially prejudiced Mr. Baxter. There is under no reading of the facts of this case. Can anyone come to the cogent conclusion that the scope of the agreement was any way similar between Mr. Baxter and Ms. Hemphill?
What do you do with Pinkerton?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
What do you do with Pinkerton?
I'm talking about in terms of the sentencing. I'm not talking about the conviction. I'm talking about whether the scope was enough.
Okay. In other words, you're not arguing on the substantive. You're arguing strictly on the sentencing.
Strictly on the sentencing. That scope was not nearly the same. And if he had properly evaluated the scope of his agreement, the judge would have excised the money laundering and embezzlements by Hemphill, Martin, Alderman, and Holmes, and the rest of those people, a significant percentage of the wanton and greedy personal purchases by Ms. Bullock and Ms. Hemphill on that American Express card, and that would have substantially reduced, A, for purposes of his restitution order, and for purposes of bringing down his guidelines sentence to something that was substantially different from where Ms. Hemphill and where Ms. Bullock was.
Ms. Jones, you're over your time. We'll give you 2 minutes for...
Thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome. Ms. Kurt.
Good Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Suzanne Kurt on behalf of the United States. Unless the court has specific questions, I will begin with the Castigar issue that was discussed during Ms. Hempel's presentation. Your Honors, we believe that Appellant Hempel persists in making two fundamental errors here. One, that she was entitled to a Castigar-type hearings based on the agreement into which she entered, and number two, that the government bore a burden here in this case. We think that both of those are fundamentally incorrect. The agreement itself specifically states that the government was entitled to derivative use of her statements. Based on this court's opinion in Kilroy, it was very clear that if there was a breach to be shown, it was then Appellant Hempel's burden to show that the government made derivative use. She had many, many opportunities to do that and did not do so. And therefore, she simply cannot prevail in this claim.
What about her argument that the one officer testified in the grand jury and testified along the lines directly of her statement?
Can I just interrupt here for just 1 second? When you said prove derivative use, you mean prove direct
use. Prove direct use. I'm sorry, I misspoke. Yes, it was her burden to prove direct use. To answer your question, Judge Silberman, I don't know. I have really no idea of what she's talking about when she says that Special Agent Andrews knew nothing else other than what Ms. Hempel told her when she testified for the very first time in the grand jury. In our papers that are at the appendix 702, we describe many other things that the government knew beforehand, and I simply think that there is no basis for those allegations. She also there isn't. And secondly, she also stated that when referring to Mr. Novak, that he prepared a chart based on the testimony. I really don't know what she's talking about there either.
Chart would be derivative.
Yes, and his charts were based on the American Express bills and the checks and so forth and so on. So any use that appellants have alleged in this case is clearly derivative and clearly what we were entitled to do under the agreement itself.
Suppose the officer had testified in hoc verba precisely what she had said. He got before the grand jury and said, she said X, Y, Z, D. That's the end. Would that be enough for her to trigger? Would she have established her burden for a Castigar hearing?
Yes, and that did not happen
in this
case. She
wouldn't only have proven the burden. She wouldn't have proven a violation of the agreement. Right.
That would
be a direct use. The defendant told me the following. The defendant made the following statement, right?
Yes, and that clearly that did not happen here. And unless, does the court have further questions on that issue, we think it's clear that the government prevails and that the trial judge did not err.
Can I ask you about the charts issue?
Yes.
Actually, if I could just go actually through some of Ms. Lukey's points.
Yes.
What's your answer to her point that the government agrees that an affidavit was required under the affidavits rule? On business records and that it wasn't provided?
We certainly haven't conceded error here. We did provide the 90211 certifications to the defense counsel for every document that we admitted as a business record in conjunction with Rule 1006 and 90211. What they're complaining about now is that those certifications, which were proffered to the court without objection, were not actually admitted into evidence. This is an argument that they are raising for the first time in their reply brief, and we do not think that the court should consider it. In any event, we think any error would be harmless. Although the rule suggests that some of these documents would be admitted into evidence, when you read 90211 in conjunction with 1006, under 1006, the documents themselves don't have to be admitted into evidence, and it would make little sense to have the certification required to be admitted, but not the underlying documents themselves. So we think that any error would be absolutely harmless.
What is your response to her first argument on the speedy trial?
On the speedy trial, we think it's extremely clear that any motion can toll the the running of the Speedy Trial Act, Speedy Trial Clock. Appellant claims that the government can't do it by filing its own motion.
Isn't it rather peculiar to file a motion saying the defense needs more time when the defense says we don't need more time?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that's everything that our motion said. It's clear that this case was complex. I think we start from that position, and Judge Leon recognized that.
Did you say in your motion it was complex?
Yes, we did.
I thought I remembered that.
Yes, we did. And we were producing discovery as best we could. And this was, I might add, at a convenience for the defense attorneys in order to avoid them spending days or weeks at the U.S. Attorney's Office plowing through paper after paper after paper. And that process was simply a long time, took a long time, but we did it as expeditiously as possible. The statute itself provides that the government can make this type of motion. And the statute itself, the plain language says any motion can toll the running of the clock.
Can you answer the limiting instruction?
Yes,
the limiting instruction.
Limiting instruction. Again, we don't concede error on that. A limiting instruction was not required because the evidence about which they complain was evidence of the conspiracy. We have cited many cases in our brief showing that overt acts in support of the conspiracy, and that is what they are complaining about, do not have.
They seem to agree that it could have. That it was admissible with respect to the conspiracy. Their claim is that it wasn't admissible with respect to the substantive counts.
I know of no authority that supports that proposition. The overt acts do not have to be alleged in the indictment in order for them to be admitted as evidence. And there's no proposition that you can consider evidence for one purpose but not for the other. And we stated in our brief that because it was evidence of the conspiracy, no limiting instruction needed to be given. And although Judge Leon originally contemplated giving one, later on he changed his mind, probably realizing that it wasn't required.
So your argument is that this evidence was used in the conspiracy count to prove overt acts not charged, and that evidence can also be used for everything, is that?
Yes, yes. That's our position. I think I've covered most of the issues that were raised by Ms. Hemphill during her argument. And before I move on, are there questions about Baxter that the court has? I would like to just briefly address what they discussed regarding sentencing.
One of the things that's puzzling to me about the government's brief on Baxter is there's a suggestion that his salary during the time he was working for the district is excessive. Make that suggestion?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
Well, what evidence do you have for that?
Well, Your Honor, Mrs. Bullock testified that he was not to get a regular salary and that she did not intend.
He didn't get a regular salary.
It certainly appeared in every respect that it was a regular salary because it was
less than his regular salary, wasn't it?
No, it was given out every 2 weeks regularly.
I'm asking. It was a smaller amount than he was getting when he was.
It was somewhat of a smaller amount.
Yeah, but where is there any evidence that this is inappropriate? There is a suggestion in your brief that it's inappropriate, but I couldn't find direct evidence of that.
Mrs. Bullock testified that the arrangement that was supposed to happen once he left the union and went to work for the District of Columbia was that he was supposed to keep track of his time and what he spent, you know, doing the union work, and that he was supposed to be paid on a per diem basis. But if you look at the regularity of the payments, it certainly appears to be more like a salary than that. And there was testimony that he was rarely there during the period of time, so that was the evidence that, and we think that's enough for a reasonable juror to conclude that it was excessive.
Good point.
In terms of the sentencing, we think the judge did make findings based on a preponderance of the evidence on all the disputed issues with respect to Mr. Baxter. And the judge did conclude that he was a member of the entire conspiracy. So we do think that the findings are there.
Was there an objection or a statement by the defense that he had to make findings with respect to the specific scope of the conspiracy?
I don't recall an objection that was made during the sentencing hearing, but there was a list of disputed factors that were given to the court before the sentencing hearing, and that, I believe that was among one of the factors that the court resolved before, you know, it addressed, and it did that with both with Mrs. Hemphill and Ms. Baxter. I think they had an identical list of issues in dispute, and one of them was the scope of each person's role in the, and the court did resolve that and by preponderance of the evidence and found that he was involved in the entire conspiracy. And unless there are further questions, I did want to make one very brief, call the attention to one brief clarification in our brief on page 42 at lines 6 to 7. We're describing a pleading that we filed, a Castigar pleading. And in there, I inadvertently included Michael Martin as an individual whom the government, whom the special agent interviewed before her very first testimony in front of the grand jury. And the pleading, I later learned, was not intended to create that impression. It was just not for Mr. Martin. And unless the court has any other questions, I would ask the court to affirm the judgment and thank the court for its time today.
No further questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Lukey, you can have 2 minutes.
Your Honor asked me a question that I had a moment to think about and wanted to respond to, which is whether this agreement triggered the Castigar hearing in and of itself. And I would say that you don't have to decide that, and that is not our position. Our position is that when the agent took the statement, 16 single space pages, and went into the grand jury and testified about that substance, that was enough of a use to trigger a hearing to find out how many other witnesses had done that.
But the substance is the scope of the conspiracy. It's not using it in the same sense we just talked about it. I mean, that will always be the case, right? It'll be the case agent will have investigated the conspiracy, will then at some point interview in this kind of debriefing, and then we'll go into the grand jury when that's finished and either indict or not indict. That sounds like that's always going to be the case then.
In my experience, it was never the case that if you signed an agreement like this, that agent would appear in the grand jury. But putting that aside for a minute, if that were true, I believe under the law of this circuit, and certainly the very strong language in North saying that when a witness reviews testimony and then testifies, you always, always must ask the question. And it's like cockroaches in your building. You see one, you know there's a lot more. And it makes you wonder how many witnesses read the testimony.
This is a personal testimony.
It's a personal. That's right. It's not in the record anywhere.
Can I ask you about the Speedy Trial Act? So I have the motion there. Discussing, which is at A244, and the government does say in that the district court had already said that it was a complex case. The government cites the provision with respect to complex cases and says that more time is going to be needed for discovery and trial, and then it does discuss the defendant's need for discovery.
Yes, and I would submit that is dicta. That is not the grounds for the motion, and they didn't support it. You wouldn't use that word, you're right, but it's not important to the motion. The motion was about how they didn't get us discovery and we didn't have time to review it.
Let me just see if I understand. If, let's say it is a case in which there are a billion documents. They say here it's 17,000 images which they have already produced.
Of evidence that was not relevant to the counts charged, by the way.
That's a different question because I can't evaluate that by looking at this document. I mean, they don't say that it dictated or not.
They
don't say it's not relevant. Is your view that the amount of evidence that the government has to turn over can never make the case complex because the government really has to turn it over immediately?
No. It just wasn't complex in this case. None of the defendants thought it was complex. None of us wanted more time. We all wanted to go.
Here you haven't gotten all the discovery yet. You didn't want the rest of the discovery?
But I would have. It wouldn't have mattered because if the government doesn't give me the discovery, then they're going to have a hard time introducing it at trial.
You're back to the position, it seems to me, that you were in the outset, which is do you have to assert that the judge capriciously concluded that it was complex in order to prevail.
I think what
the standard of review on that is pretty limited.
It is, Your Honor, but as I said, I don't think that motion should have told the clock. I think it was pretextual. But I want to make two other points, and I know you're
a minute
losing
over your 2 minutes.
I know, but
so
can
if you
I
could make them in like a negative 1 minute, that would be
well, that's hard to do. I wanted to reiterate something about Castigar. We did not ever talk about derivative evidence. That it, the issue is whether this was direct use. The government, I may have used sloppy language.
Got
but,
that.
On 105, the court didn't later change its mind. There's no evidence in the record of that. The court simply refused to give a limiting instruction on the issue of whether that evidence was relevant to the embezzlements. On the 902, they didn't proffer it without objection. They began to proffer it. The court said, not now, and we never even got to discuss the 902. It was never discussed again. It was never raised again. It certainly wasn't my burden to bring up that they hadn't laid the proper foundation for all this evidence. On 106 and Kim, the argument was, that, well, the charts could come in without there being a 902, but that's not correct. Charts can't come in unless every piece of evidence on the chart was admissible, and every piece of chart evidence on the chart has to be admissible by way of a 902 cert. So that argument sort of encapsulates the whole problem, and I'm going to end on this, which is this was a trial by charts full of evidence that had not been properly authenticated or properly admitted, and about which it was very, very difficult to do very much, especially with no limiting instruction, telling the jury why these charts were going back to the room with them and what they were supposed to look at. And I really think, given U.S. North, we at least deserved a Castigar hearing.
Well, counsel, and with respect to the North point, remember, North is immunized testimony.
Yes, Your Honor.
Held immunized testimony. The burden shifts there. In this case, you have an agreement. You have the burden of showing the violation of the agreement. It's a different structure.
But, Your Honor, wouldn't you agree that I have the burden of showing what I think is a use, and then I would get a hearing in order to have the process, to have the witnesses talk to me?
The question is whether you've shown enough.
To get the hearing?
Yes.
But, Your Honor, what would you have to show?
You'd have to show somebody using absolute direct use and only direct use.
On the chart, that person testified he'd read her testimony, and then he testified. The judge.
Everybody's going to read the testimony in order to use it for derivative purposes.
There seems to be a disagreement.
That's not going to help.
But the cases the government cites on derivative specifically say you have to transform the evidence by getting it from another witness. This man wasn't a witness. He was a conduit of information for Mrs. Hemphill.
I think we have your point.
Okay. Thank you for indulging me.
Thank you.
And if you all, Your Honors, could indulge me for just about a minute and a half.
Another negative one.
Your Honor, as to the question that you asked me with regard to the pleadings pre-sentence,
yes.
There was a sentencing memorandum filed by Ms. Roberts on the January 3rd of 2006, and that is in the docket of as document number 208.
Is it in the appendix?
It is not in the okay. Joint appendix, Your
Honor. But it's approximately what Ms. Kurt was talking about?
Yes, yeah. and that there were voluminous pleadings before sentence. You have to remember that there was almost a year difference between
know,
the time that they were convicted and
the
time they
were
sentenced.
But you also gave us like a voluminous amount of appendices here, which I've diligently read, but I did not see that document in it. So
well, that's one. There was a joint document filed
so
by
docket number 208. Okay.
208. Docket number 273, a joint submission by the parties as to material issues. A supplemental objection by Mr. Baxter's sentencing
none
counsel.
None of this is in these six volumes.
It is. None of these are in the six volumes.
What's the docket number?
And that is 290.
Uh-huh.
And I believe that's it, Your Honor. But the government has to concede that the gravamen of the issues for all of the parties before sentencing was what was the scope of each defendant's participation, whether it was in terms of the time of when they...
She did concede.
Okay.
That this occurred,
so I will only argue, Your Honor, or point out that the government's argument relative to Mr. Baxter's salary is indicative of the contradictory nature of the evidence and the proof against him by the government. It was almost like damned if he did, damned if he didn't. If the government had come in and there was evidence that Mr. Baxter got intermittent payments and checks off the books and things like that, well, they would have argued, hey, he's part of the conspiracy. But when Mr. Baxter gets a regular paycheck every 2 weeks, like everybody else does, pays his taxes, all of a sudden, the government still has to argue that that was it was indicative of criminal intent on his part. And that is just one of many examples in which...
How about that? I do recall there were a couple of $9,999 deposits, weren't there?
Pension contributions, yes, Your Honor.
Yes.
There was evidence...
That's a strange figure to pick, isn't it?
Well, it was precisely the percentage of what he of his earned income, and then the government doesn't contradict that.
Had nothing to do with the bank secrecy.
Were there any documents?
Is there any evidence that he knew that there was some
documents indicating that he was depleting his pension rights by taking this money?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Were there any documents indicating that he was taking this out of his pension? You're saying that this was a payment of his pension, right?
Correct.
And I assume therefore he would not have been entitled to the same amount from the pension administration.
That's right.
And was there any document indicating that that's what this was?
Other than the notations on the checks, no, Your Honor.
Anything that would have bound the pension administrator? I mean, what would have stopped him from asking for the same, 20 years from now, saying it's time for my pension and I haven't been paid?
Your Honor, I would argue that's exactly the point. That your point is speculative at best, but the fact that he didn't do that, he didn't double dip, Your Honor.
Yeah,
there is no evidence of that.
You don't think it's unusual to have your pension come out not from the pension plan, but from some other source? That doesn't raise at least a red flag that maybe it's not really a pension?
Not when there are other employees in the union who were not charged were getting the administered or getting pension payments in the same manner.
Which ones were those? Which employees were those?
Martha Britton had testified that she had gotten at least one pension payment outside of the administrator, and the government's expert indicated that, well, yeah, it's unusual, but it's not something that's completely out of the ordinary.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You got an extra two.